today's guest on Back to School is Laura McInerney. Laura is a former teacher, education journalist, co-founder of Teacher Tap, and a regular face on panel shows, news broadcasts, and speaker at conferences. And with so much out there about what Laura thinks about education and schools, it was really amazing. It felt special to be able to explore some of the stories that Laura tells less often and to hear a bit about her experiences of school and learning and how she viewed them then compared to how she views them now. There were some themes of authority and empowerment that really came through, and I came away from our conversation really hearing that Laura thinks about school and education as a tool for helping people to change their lives, society, and the world more broadly. So let's get into it. Laura, hello. It's so lovely to have you to chat with. And I suppose for context, it's a multi-layered back to school episode for me, because of course you bring all of your expertise in the area of education, and you also contributed to training me as a teacher as well. So there's this kind of multi-angle element, which I'm sure is going to be really fun for me, at least.
No, I'm excited. It's good to see you all grown up, Joe.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's the thing about being a teacher or a pupil, is you have these permanent dynamics of Ms. and Sir.
It's true. I'm actually godmother to one of my pupils' daughters. And so it's really funny when I'm there at like christenings or, you know, sort of weddings or whatever else, that everybody is still from my pupils. And there's this extent where it's many, many years later. It's about, I don't know, 15 years since I taught them. And there's still an extent to which people go, Miss, Laura, Miss, which one are you again?
Yeah, it's a really nice way of framing the entire episode, I suppose, which is that I feel like our early experiences of school and learning as a child can ripple through our lives in terms of how we view education and also how we navigate the workplace. And so if you're willing to step into a time machine and take yourself back to primary school times, I wonder what kinds of memories pop into your head.
So I went to a open plan primary school called Lunts Heath County Primary, which I absolutely loved. And to be clear, I really liked school. So I'm a person who likes to sit down, write, think, be quite quiet, not move for long periods of time. So school is really made for me, you know? And my memories of Lunts Heath are of somewhere that I felt very safe, very warm, very happy. I think my first teacher became the head teacher quite rapidly and stayed there the entire time. So I always didn't have that sense of a head teacher being this big scary thing. It was that teacher that I fell in love with because I'd gone to school and I told everybody what Mrs. Lippitt thought. But the one memory that stands out, which isn't positive and I think did have an impact on me for a very long time in my life and in my teaching, is that when I was in about year three or four, I had a teacher who got us to do the topic, the circus, because this is just slightly or no one really cares yet about national curriculum. We spent many weeks on the circus. Now, one of the things we had to do was do a drawing of a circus. Now, I was good at everything at school except drawing. But I remember very diligently working hard on this drawing of a big top. I did the top of the circus, you know, it was also yellow and red. Then I did the stage. And it was from the perspective of somebody looking from the audience onto the stage. And I got held back at the break time. And I was told that I hadn't drawn an audience. And so it was wrong. But I was so proud of this picture. And I tried to explain and I didn't want to change it. And I'd worked so hard at it. And she made me stay in at break. And I have just this distinct memory of sitting there with everybody playing outside. I could hear the tears rolling down my face. And I just drew these two hideous faces sort of over the top of the drawing. And I have it. And it has the tear marks on it. And I found it when I was about 25. And I'd always had this memory. But at some point, I'd thought, you know, I've probably embellished this. It was probably all a bit made up. And then I found this horrid drawing in the booklet that I'd taken home about the circus. And that stayed with me. You know, you can have such a profound impact on children. And I refused to draw, I mean, probably for the next 10 years. You couldn't get it out of me. Art teachers were the only people who had any trouble with me at school.
Wow. I am really struck by that image of you finding this drawing with the literal layers, the wonderful drawing that you put a lot of effort into, the faces that were kind of the rebellion / despoiling, and then the tears as well. It's very, very rich.
I mean, I tell you, there's something about, you can see the distress in these faces and the happiness of the circus, and you can sort of see that thing about art being a place where we are able to express our emotions, sometimes subconsciously or not. And I've never really done any artwork with young people, but certainly I could see how there was a communication happening in such an interesting way if you were to look at it and not be sat inside the experience.
Yeah, I mean, you're taking me back to my experience of nursery and my, or not even my experience, my parents relaying of my nursery parent evening, and the way that the story is told in my family is like they felt like they had to say something, you know, like critical, or like to kind of like even better if, and so they said you couldn't use scissors, and like it's still, yeah, still to this day I have a narrative around me not being that good using scissors, which is just yeah, is that, you know, anyway, I think I'm very much struck by what you said about really liking to sit and absorb, and school being kind of made for you, and that you had this experience where you tried to explain about your work and it wasn't received. And I suppose, yeah, I'm interested how it is for you kind of going back to primary school and noticing this moment where you tried to kind of share your perspective on a piece of work, but it wasn't necessarily received or heard.
I mean, I was a really kind of old-headed child. I was an only child, and I think I spent a lot of time around adults. I also had parents who weren't particular. My mom is the sort of person who sort of treats you like, you know, you're 35 when you're 3. And she does that with all children, and it has lots of positives, but also it does mean that you're not always aware of your age in the world or how you're perceived by other people. And, you know, if you're 7, how good are you going to be at that? And I think that was a bit of a theme throughout my life. Like any time where I did get in trouble at school or I had any issues, it was largely because this very tiny little dot of a person was sort of acting like she was in charge of the school rather than listening to people. And I saw that when I became a teacher, and also when I was training teachers, how people understand authority in a classroom and their expectations of how people should defer to them or not defer to them is really interesting. And I guess as somebody who was always on the side of being more of an equal and expecting to be listened to, I was always in favor of doing that. Where I fell down is I also expect all children to be able to explain themselves, to be able to put themselves forward in that way. And I had to learn that, you know, not everybody would speak up or not everybody would do things, and kind of account for that as well.
Yeah, there's a very interesting dynamic there of how you might expect to be treated versus how you're received by other people and their expectations of you in that context as well.
Yeah, and one of the interesting ones on this is there's now a program called Now Teach. So if anybody has kind of already had a career and is thinking of going into teaching, you can do through Now Teach, you can go in and become a teacher as a sort of second or third career. A lot of those people, I think, really struggle when they get there because they've had these careers. And now when you're a teacher, you are just sort of one of many teachers, especially in a secondary school, and especially where you've got leaders in a school who are used to demanding things of people, talking down, talking authoritatively. You sometimes do that to the other adults without really realizing. And I think if you've come from outside the education sector and you're used to being talked to more on an adult level, to suddenly have somebody talk to you as if you're a child is really jarring. And they're not doing it on purpose. It's just part of the kind of institution of schools. But that adult child thing obviously goes through schools all the way, and it is something that people have to learn to emotionally manage, deal with, talk about. But you can't be doing that every 2 minutes when you've also got to look after 30 children.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful point, the adult child dynamic. I mean, something I feel I've noticed going into lots of different schools as a psychologist is that sometimes that dynamic can play out amongst the staff and the leadership team. And that can be quite curious, seeing adults acting or being treated as if maybe they're a lot less powerful or able to be autonomous. And there is something quite unique about schools in that sense.
I think if you spend a lot of your time around young people in which you are the authority, I mean, I certainly felt that as a teacher, there were certain points when you get good at it, you're essentially manipulating 30 people all at once en masse, hour after hour after hour. And there is a point where you're almost like, my goodness me, I know if I stand here and hold my pen like this, I can close everybody down and they'll suddenly be silent. And you have to learn almost not to lean into that, because it can feel very powerful. And I've seen people get carried away with it and then reining it back in, because the students also know, they sensitively pick up if you're doing it from a power grab perspective, or if you're doing it for them, or why you're doing it. And again, when you're training teachers and they're in the maelstrom of all of those experiences, that's hard for them to manage as well. And so who knows what was going on that day? She was a new teacher, I think, or a reasonably young teacher. Who knows why she kept me in at break time? What I might have triggered in her with my explanation, or maybe she had asked me to do an audience and I hadn't, and I just hadn't noticed. It's so hard that something that for her was probably experienced completely differently and with great intentions ended up being this thing that affected me for 10 years and made me not want to do an activity. I don't know how I'd have gone on with scissors. How are you with scissors now?
Well, I avoid them at all costs, to be honest.
Still.
Functionally I can use scissors, but if we got art and crafty, I would feel a bit tense picking them up.
It's so powerful. Bill Watkins once talked about, the head of the Sixth Form Association, the idea that children don't opt into subjects. It's that by our teenage years, it's what we're left with that nobody has taken from us, or we've decided we cannot do. And I think that's really interesting. So art for me, and probably for yourself with the craft side, there's an age you get to and you're like, that's not mine. Okay, like I've dropped that now. But these other subjects, for me, any subject which involves sitting down and writing, which luckily was about 95% of them, those are my subjects.
Yeah, that's a really lovely quote. And it kind of builds on the dynamic you were describing of how for that young, potentially inexperienced teacher, from your memory, you were one of very many children. But for you, it is this incredibly powerful subjective experience. And so, I feel like we're kind of brushing up against quite a powerful insight into the balancing of the educational experience. But I want to get back into the time machine. I don't know if you're happy to leave primary school behind.
Yeah, we can. Bye-bye, Lonty.
Bye. So, yeah, let's fast forward through time closer to the present day. And we can land in secondary school. So I wonder what kinds of memories are coming up for you from, between those ages, 11, 16.
Yep. So I went to a secondary school that's now closed called Fairfield High School. It was your standard in the 90s. Comprehensive school that was near to what had once been the grammar school comprehensive school. So we were the sort of more secondary modern comprehensive school, and I think that legacy definitely stood. It was quite challenging, 10th form entry, big, quite brutal, a couple of periods of time of being knocked about a bit, I think, by some of the older kids. So it doesn't feel as safe, I think, and I was in a form group that was notoriously difficult. Someone, I think, had the bright idea of taking a kind of smart, best behaved kids and putting them with the worst behaved children. This is a terrible approach. And it's terrible because what you learn is that smart children are extremely good at manipulating those children who are often less well behaved, but more vulnerable and less academically intelligent. And therefore, what you ended up with was a lot of kids that that got away with stuff because they were smart and very charismatic and had kind of worked on that, and they just riled up the others to have their fun. We had lots and lots of different form tutors. It caused us lots of problems, which is why my big outstanding memory of secondary school is this woman called Miss Watson. And Miss Watson got our form in year 9. And we'd heard about it. We all knew she was terrifying. So I think that she had that going for her. But, you know, we were 70 and 80, right? We could take anybody down. We were it. And, I mean, she spent 6 months at it, and she made us into the most glorious group of children you would ever see. And she did it, I think, by doing two things simultaneously at once, realizing that a class is both an entity in itself and 30 separate children. And the trick is to get them to feel a team while also breaking them down individually so that you can build yourself into that team, knowing each and every one of them, and then kind of get them pointed in a positive direction. So a couple of things she did, she made us all give a presentation where we had to talk about something in our life. And we had to do it. There was no getting out of it. She went after people for weeks if they kept avoiding it, which was rubbish and embarrassing and terrible. But I realized was about vulnerability, making each of us know each other as a person beyond 80 nightmare. And the second thing she did was she used to break us into teams randomly out of a hat. So there was no arguing about what team you were in. And then we would do these little quizzes, and she would mark them at break time, and she'd have a little league table on the wall, and we would all come back to see it. And what she did was she broke us into smaller units, got us all kind of working positively, and then just had relationships with us. And my speech was about Terry Pratchett, how I loved his books. And she brought me a Sunday Times Magazine article about Terry Pratchett. Well, first of all, I'd never seen a newspaper magazine. I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that authors did interviews. It sounds like I hadn't seen the world at 13, but it just wasn't in my world at home. That wasn't a thing that we did. Yeah, but also what I couldn't get over, and I still have it to this day, I couldn't get over the fact that a teacher had thought about me on a Sunday. It was miraculous. It changed so much about our relationship. The other thing I saw her do was, there was one day my friend Emma used to come in every morning with nail varnish on. And every single day, Miss Watson would put down nail varnish remover and cotton wool buds, and she would have to take it off. And there came this day after about 6 months where Emma very triumphantly slaps down the empty bottle and says, "It's empty." And we all go quiet. And Miss Watson, in a move that can only be described as sort of ballet dancer-like grace, gets the bottle, throws it in the bin, opens the cupboard door, takes out another bottle, spins again, puts it down, and slinks away. And in that moment, we all knew we were beat. Like, here is a woman who will do this every day for 6 months, and when we think we've got her beat, she's going to open her magical cupboard and have another tactic for us. And she got us on track. She got me A stars in French, which I hated. She got lots of my friends who didn't pass anything A stars in that one subject. Extraordinary. And she taught me a lot about group dynamics, understanding people personally, and the power of tenacity.
Yeah, there's so much in that recounting, and you made me smile just thinking of my equivalent memories of adults with the perfectly timed riposte or response or whatever it is. And it just I wonder if it, I don't know how this sounds to you, but I wonder if it builds on what you were talking about earlier in terms of children just knowing where something's coming from intuitively. Is it coming from a place of I'm trying to assert power, or is it coming from a place of I actually have your best interests at heart and I care about you? I think there's lots of advice for teachers about how to navigate behavior management or, you know, their professional persona. And I suppose you can hear advice from different ends of the spectrum of approaches. But I do think that there's something that maybe overarches that around authenticity and actually trying to be yourself and search for tokens that you can give out that you do trust and care about these children. You know, like that nail varnish remover could have been interpreted as, I'm an adult, I have more resources than you, I'm always going to win. Or it could be interpreted as, do you know what, you knew we were getting to the end of that bottle and you went out and you bought another bottle because you care.
One of the things I used to do on teacher training, I may have done it with you, is I used to get people to look at their three favorite teachers and look at what they have in common and what they're different about. And there's often some superficial, you know, what seem like superficial similarities, often lots and lots of differences that people can note. The two things that are always similar are people typically pick someone that's very authentic. Like you could slice them open and they would bleed out who they were. You knew on a Monday what they'd be like, on a Friday would be the same. And the other thing is that they cared about you in some way. And as you say, over the years, when people have told me their stories of their teachers, there's lots and lots of different ways that people can show that they care. And so that's why everyone doesn't pick the same three teachers. And also why you have three. Across a school, lots of children need lots of different things. And the idea that you're ever going to be the best teacher for that child or for every child is just impossible. You're probably going to be important for some children at some point. And for others, someone else will fulfill that. And it's very hard as a teacher because you want to be amazing for everybody. But actually, you can't. You can be kind of consistent and there and do a good job with the teaching. But being that kind of life-changing thing, that's just about stars aligning sometimes and who you look for and what you need in your life. And I've needed different people at different times.
So, I mean, that makes me immediately curious. What were some of your things at secondary school, you know, that you gained from other people or that felt important for getting you through that?
I definitely had a number of teachers who were very similar to Miss Watson, who I would say were just very, very consistent. And in a school that was quite challenging, where I did like to learn, having those spaces where I could walk in and know that somebody was going to be strong enough to say, folks, we have a mission that we're on for 50 minutes. This is how it's going to go. And I'm going to make sure that we all do this because it's important for everybody in here that we do this. For me, I needed that a lot of the time. I needed to feel like other people cared about learning. I would say that other people needed different things, and that's why they probably looked to other teachers. I know there were some very humorous teachers, there were some very laid back teachers. Lots of people in my school didn't find learning particularly easy. And so they would often look to, we had a great drama teacher, great PE teachers. And so they would look to them for different things. But for me, that consistency was really, really important. I don't know what you would say, Joe, about what things you would look for, or if there's any commonalities with the teachers that you stand out for you.
It's interesting thinking back. Across primary and secondary school, there was definitely something around authenticity and consistency. I think something else that comes to mind from the conversations I've had so far is that quite often the teachers that are perceived as scary or strict, you use the word terrifying, they can sometimes be the favorites. And I think there's an interesting interplay between structure and safety, you know, predictability, consistency, and perceived safety. It's hard to say. And actually, you know, just a phrase that stood out to me there was needing to know that people cared about learning. And I'm not sure I got that as much at my secondary school. And that did influence my choice for how I approached going to college. So yeah, it's probably looking back, that was a bit of an unmet need at that time, I think.
How did it influence your choice of college?
Well, I didn't go to the college that everyone else went to, which was City and Islington, and I decided to go to Camden School for Girls Sixth Form, which is it's got a history of being quite radical and progressive and really caring about academia, and it was selective in the sense that it asked for 5 B's, not 5 C's, and you had an interview to kind of get a sense of who you were before you went. And so yeah, that was me being like, do you know what, I want to be able to learn and not be ducking stuff getting thrown or be scared about violence. And it's interesting looking at the way you can access options as a child. And like, that was something that I was like, this is an option for me and I'm going to do it, kind of from a searching of wanting to know that people care about learning too. And inevitably, there are flip sides or the other side of the coin to, yeah, to those decisions, which is part of life and navigating it.
One of the things, so I did the opposite, bizarrely. So when I got to 16, I actually went to a further education adult centre. So at that time, it was built really so that A-levels were done in what was called block day release. It kind of disappeared after A-levels became AS levels. So post 2001 or 2000, you could do this. But I did my GCSEs in 1999. So I just snuck in as the door was closing. And essentially, they did these A-levels of big three-hour blocks so that you could take an afternoon off of work. So a receptionist might go and do an A-level in German, or in my case, I did A-level psychology. We had a number of people who were in various forms of care at that time. So we had someone who was schizophrenic who was in our class. We had someone who'd been in a car accident. And so he was in there. We had someone else who were trying to think, but a variety of different people who then, that was part of the class. And that was part of why they were there. And they would talk about their experiences. Vince in particular with his schizophrenia, I think was really important at that time for talking to me about somebody who had voices, and he managed it really, really well. And one of the things that was really difficult was exams for him, because he would say that would when they would get particularly loud and he knew he couldn't say anything. And it was brilliant. I did a film studies A-level with someone who'd pioneered film studies. We were joined to a university where they did film studies. We had this incredible facilities. You could get any film that you wanted, which in 1999 was not something you could normally do. And I also worked at McDonald's. So about 30 hours a week, combined that with doing this and some night school, so I could build a full curriculum around it. Now, given what you've just said about how much I loved learning, that suddenly seems quite a weird thing to have done. I've always thought it seemed seemed sensible. And the reason I thought it seemed sensible was the sixth form college was sort of similar to our school. It would be the same people. It would be a bit hit and miss. I didn't know if people would be into learning or not, but it looked a lot like school. Whereas I felt by 16, I've got this, right? Whether the teacher is into this or not, whether everybody else is into this or not, I've got it. And what I don't want is to keep recreating this school child adult thing dynamic. I'd just rather go somewhere where we call the adults by their name. Everybody is older, and that seven-year-old who's not been able to kind of speak up for a long time is just equal to everybody else. And it worked incredibly well for me. It's one of my best choices. Obviously, I didn't get the amazing teaching I might have had somewhere else, although in the case of film studies, exceptional. But it gave me a lot of freedom, a lot of independence. And I did manage to get to Oxford, which is really unusual from that kind of FE night school background. But of course, they found it weird. We tell kids sometimes that you've got to fit into all of these categories to get into the elite. You know, the elite people want you to have read books I still haven't read. I don't know, Dickens or something, or you need to know your Orwell from your something else. And I don't think that's true. I think you often have to just be willing to learn. I'm really sorry I haven't read Dickens. Tell me about it. Not be ashamed of who you are. And also show that you're bringing something else, right? Like I did five A-levels. I'd worked my socks off. I could definitely prove that I deserved to be there because I liked learning as much as anybody did. And it worked out, thankfully.
There's so much in there that I want to pick up on. But the thing that feels most pressing to ask you, which is, it's a bit of a tangent, is just that on your personal website, you have a logo which is a yellow jacket, which is like, you know, a bit of a thing. But it also does look quite similar to another very famous logo.
What it looks like McDonald's.
It's the golden arches.
I'm so proud of that. Oh, wow. Where is it? I usually have it out. I have my golden arches trophy. I won a trophy when I was at McDonald's, and it's the only trophy I usually have out.
I'm now thinking, like, you could have a Mo Farah style persona where you just do like an M for McInerney / McDonald's.
I should start doing that. When I have the yellow jacket on, I'm going to start doing an M above my head. Look, McDonald's was as formative as college for me. I did it for 3 or 4 years. I won the super team backer of the year. Thank you very much. A backer is the person who, when you're taking your order on very busy days, someone should be behind them going and getting the order. the very specific order you're supposed to do it in. And in the year 2000, I was exceptional at it.
Yeah, I do feel like from what you've shared about after secondary school, there's kind of an interesting dual pillar where you have one pillar being the professional experience. You know, I can have a work part of my life and a really like learning part of my life. I can also progress at work. I can learn from my employer. I can appreciate their systems and processes. And also you can have this, this kind of FE experience, which it's interesting for me to hear you say you didn't think that was about loving learning, because I almost viewed it the opposite way listening to you, which was that you wanted to own it and just do it your way. I wonder if...
I like that interpretation better. Let's have that one.
Well, I mean, it's about what resonates for you, but yeah, it's good to check interpretations. I think, yeah, it does make me wonder whether you, as a someone who likes to take ownership of their learning, have any other powerful memories of learning as an adult?
A lot of it is the sixth form, but I also did Teach First in 2006, which at that time was still a very early program. And if people don't know what Teach First is, it's a program that takes people who haven't taught previously but are graduates and places them in schools. In 2006, that was predominantly in London, in challenging schools where they literally couldn't get staff. I mean, when I turned up, there were just endless cover teachers. The schools in London in the mid-2000s were not what they are now. And you were placed in there with 2 years and you were given your training on the job. So you sort of learn to teach as you go. And I had a tutor called Maggie, who was unbelievable. I think a huge part of me staying in education longer than the 2 years, I'm teaching for 6 years and only came out of teaching because of weird circumstances, I'd go back, I will at some point go back, I'm sure. And I think she was, again, that same modelling of authenticity, consistency. She did some extremely good modelling. I don't think teacher training always does this as well as it could do. So, for example, she would observe me in a lesson and she would just write down anything that was said and questions, said and questions, said and questions. And at the end, there would be this very intense 45-minute conversation in which she would say, you said this thing. Why did you say that? What happened when you said that? What did you notice when you said that? Detail, detail, detail. And then at a certain point, she would often get me, if we could, to stay in the same classroom and go back and stand where I was when that thing happened and redo it. Say it differently. Say it louder. Say it quieter. And she would act how the child had been or sit where the child was, get me to think through again how I could do it. I think that was so powerful. And I wish everybody had that experience of their teacher training, because from what I hear, it's quite unusual, but it's so helpful. And I was also lucky in my teaching that I taught a subject called citizenship, which enabled me to often teach the same year group again and again. So I would teach, say, everybody in year seven. So I could do that lesson 6 times. And that repetition is really, really important. And it's something that you don't always get in other professions. You don't always get in teaching. But if we can create experiences for learning that enable people to practice and get better, do so with really good curiosity and modeling, then I think it's such a powerful way of learning. And I wouldn't have been a good teacher. I was, by the end of 2 years, I was a really good teacher. I was horrible on day one. And it was purely how good the training was and how good the experience of my school was, not me.
Yeah, I really am struck by that process of getting you to think about how children responded to what you said and trying it in different ways. It reminds me of video enhanced reflective practice, where practitioners literally record themselves and then analyze the footage. It's maybe a slightly more technology-free version of that. But yeah, really powerful tool for encouraging perspective taking and thinking about the importance of all of the things you're doing as a teacher. You know, it's such a time-restricted moment where you have an hour, 50 minutes to try and impart useful stuff.
I mean, I think lots of jobs have this where essentially your voice, your hands, your body, your words. You have a very limited set of things in which you need to get people to do things. Now, hopefully, if you're a police officer interviewing a witness, for example, you've got longer, there's only one person that you're trying to talk to. One of the difficulties of teachers is it's all of that and you've got 30 people plus an environment to manage. You've got to get them in, get them out and get stuff done very, very quickly. That's what makes it cool and fun and interesting, but also very hard for beginners because there's so many layers. And she would often break it down and be like, right, in the next week, focus on your voice. And actually voice, I think, is one of the first places that teachers have to work on. To this day, I can usually tell if it's half term walking around at a restaurant, you know, in Pret or something, you can hear people give their order. You can usually spot the teachers by their voices because you're trained to do it. And I think she just broke that down really, really nicely. It's a fascinating way of learning. In terms of the reflection, I think what you said there about it being about the kids' perspective, though, not just about you. One of the problems when people watch back on video, I don't know how they do it when you're training people in other professions, but one of the problems is people can often just focus on themselves and small things that they don't like about themselves that nobody else is even noticing. And Maggie was exceptional for every now and then she would stop me. And if someone was being shouted at in the corridor, you'd hear this teacher roaring, you know, at a child, what are you? You're not good for nothing. When you leave here, these terrible things will happen to you if you don't listen to me. And she would very quietly recant what she thought the kid might be saying. So she'd go, you don't know anything about me. Maybe I want to go and work there. Maybe I don't want to be anything like you. Actually, you're standing shouting at me right now and I'm the person being calm. And that was great. We don't know that's what that kid was thinking, but it showed that there was an alternative. And again, with that video reflection, or when people are observing somebody else, when you're thinking about your practice, just trying to put yourself in that other position is very, very challenging, but really important.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could talk for hours about the social and emotional processes that happen within a school, but it's a really big ask trying to hold that many children's experience in your mind at once. And certainly for me, like, that was the rush of teaching, is that every now and again you have these moments where you felt absolutely in tune with the class. And in that moment, you know, okay, you're done with the task, you're struggling with the task, you're talking. But it's incredibly powerful to feel that closely linked in with people's experiences. I feel like we talked about so many important things, and I just want to say back a few words to you that stood out to me, and I get your response. So,
getting my pen.
Hey, it's the teacher in you to have a pen to hand at all time.
I'm gonna mark it afterwards. How well I did? No, I'm not. I promise.
Authority. Expected to be listened to. Consistent. Strong enough. Important that other people care about learning. Modeling. And then one that I can't read my own writing on, which was important at the time, but we'll forever not know. I these are some of the words that I jotted down as we were talking about your time machine journey. And I don't know how it feels to hear them or read them back.
They're not surprising. I think in many parts they're why I became a citizenship teacher, because I worry, having grown up in the community that I grew up in, which was, I sort of think of my family as very normal. I feel like most people do that. But actually there's lots of poverty in the community that I grew up in, looking back. And also that people were taken advantage of and were quite vulnerable. I've talked before on different things about the fact that I grew up kind of with Hillsborough very aware of. My dad was a Liverpool fan. This was something that affected people in our town. And so this idea of kind of authority, expected to be listened to, modelling, comes from this place of wanting people to be educated so that they can stand up for themselves and not passively accept things in their lives that they're not happy with. So I'm not sort of surprised by those. And then I guess the kind of the consistent important that people learn is about the fact that I think that helps people do that. On the flip side, when you see it written down like that, I always slightly gurn at the idea that it sounds as if I'm being very draconian or that I'm very bossy. But I feel like most people, when they're told things back about themselves that they know, they don't always love them. The word that has been used about me forever, people always call me sensible, sensible Laura. From when I was 5 years old through to now, people will go, well, the thing with you, Laura, is you come up with sensible ideas. And it's true, and I hate it. But that's because those stories, as you said before, every choice has a flip side. Every story has a kind of shadow and a light. And I see the good in this, but I also know that at times these can be my downfall as well. And if I'm not listened to, that can make me angry. If the modeling isn't there, you know, I want it to be. And other people don't always need it. Most people are chill. They're quite happy to kind of be laid back about things.
Sensible is such a interesting word. I can see how you might not like aspects of it. I almost, when you said sensible, I thought of the word nice. Like, oh, nice, sensible. But I am curious that that's the word that you feel like has followed you, because as you were describing the area you grew up in and the time you grew up in, the words that I wrote down were empowered and not passive. And I do wonder if within that sensibility, there's also something about empowering people to be able to change their situations, which is not sensible. Well, it is sensible. Maybe we're finding for the radical within sensibility here.
Well, I think it can always go both ways, and there's different ways of living, right? And there's lots to be said for taking an approach to life which is, this is how things are, I can't change it, I accept it, you know, the kind of radical Buddhist almost way of being. And my way can be a bit stressful, so it's probably about taking both of those things and putting them together in some way. And that's my life's journey, right? Like, how do you try and bring these things authentically so that they can reach the maximum number of people, knowing that you never will, but try to make sure that people, if they are being passive, they're not allowing bad things to happen just because it's uncomfortable or they don't have the skills necessary to stand up for themselves. It's one thing to go, I'm happy here and I don't mind. It's another one to say that because actually it's too scary to try and make a change.
Well, I think that's a really beautiful note to end on. And so maybe the last thing to say from me is just an invitation to share where people can find out more about you and your work if they're interested.
Yeah, if they want to see whether or not the yellow jacket really looks like a McDonald's logo, my website, which is horribly named, is lauramcinerny.com, which of course is my name, but it's very hard to spell. I'd say it's easy to find me on Twitter. It's not. I'm at miss_McInerney. That's even harder. But it's MCINERNEY for the very dedicated teachers who are obviously already holding pens. And then beyond that, my day-to-day job is I work surveying thousands of teachers. So if anybody listening is a teacher and they would like to be part of our daily panel, we use the information to empower, make sure that politicians and the media are listening to the voices of people on the ground, then please join Teacher Tap. And that's Teacher Tap with two P's, because I can't have anything that is spelled simply.
You've been listening to the Sizzle podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best thing you can do to help is to subscribe to the Substack. And that way you'll get all new episodes straight to your email. And you'll be first up for articles, resources, and lots of other goodies. And also to share it, you know, send the podcast to people that you think might enjoy it. Catch you next time on the Sizzle podcast.